as subcommittee of the Senate Education Committee. Sorry about starting late. I don't like to do that, but seems like we do have trouble with too many committee assignments and getting people here. We're going to switch the order. We're not going by the order that's posted. I intend to start with Senate Bill 350, and then we're going to go to Senate Bill 272. And probably then go back to the top of the agenda after those two bills. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 350. And since Senator Morissette brought that bill to us, I'll ask him to introduce it. And we'll bring up the two witnesses who've signed up, Bob Siewert and Andrea Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bill Morissette, District 6, Springfield, and parts of rural Lanhaman County. This bill I introduced on behalf of the Justice of the Peace Court, Cynthia Sinclair, and unfortunately she can't be here today. I'm not going to read this testimony right now. I will simply say that she is a very caring, compassionate person who deals with school district issues when parents are cited for not having their kids in school. She hears those cases in her court, and she can levy a fine. But she's very frustrated in that she doesn't really have the tools, she feels, to do to get the parents, many of whom do have available resources. And I do have some testimony that I'm not sure is available to the public, but she mentions cases where kids in a family, two boys have one pair of pants that they wear between them, and so they don't go to school on the same day. She mentions cases where kids don't have adequate glasses, kids don't have adequate other necessary tools to deal with, and she mentions also that she picks a lot of these items up at the thrift store and drops them off at these people's homes, and she would like to be able to work more closely with these families and direct them to do some of the things that need to be done. And then she also mentions that she deals with dog control cases where she can order a person with a dog that does not have his shots to have shots. She can order that. She can order a person who has a dog running loose to tie the dog up. She can order those things with animal control, but she has no leverage over parents who neglect their children. And she wants to have a more leeway to work with parents, to require that they take parenting classes, perhaps, to require that they, and what she says in her testimony, that there are instances where, you know, services and children families can come in and deal with these cases, but she is unable to. Now, I would like to hear the testimony of those people who signed up, Andrea, and, you know, and those. Cindy Hunt is with us, I think, from the Legislative Council to clarify the penalty incurred by this additional violation, which it would be. It would be an additional violation to the truancy. So with that, I guess I would end my testimony without really going in detail to her very compelling testimony and hear what others have to say about it.
Call Bob Siewert and Andrea Morgan forward, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I apologize. I intended to sign up for Senate Bill 850, and I believe that I got my name on the wrong list. So I respectfully apologize, and will appear for 850.
Thank you. Well.
Is Andrea on this? Oh. Okay. Too bad we didn't schedule a work session. We cast this sucker off.
Just the two of us.
Yeah. Well, we don't have a work session scheduled. But anyway, or do we? No.
No, probably not. Cindy, help us understand those provisions, please.
Gosh, I was watching your face when I was testifying, thinking, I'm wondering if I was moving you.
Cindy Hunt, Legislative Counsel's Office. Sorry about that. One of your other senators needed me outside to ask some questions. Senate Bill 350, I understand there's been some questions that have been raised about whether or not the bill would apply to someone who's providing homeschooling to their child. And the simple answer is no. And here's why, is basically what the bill does is says the court may order a person convicted of violating 339.020. And what that statute says basically is that you need to send your child to school if they're between the ages of 7 and 18. But then there's exceptions to that general rule. And the exceptions include if you send your child to a private school, if you homeschool your child. If the child already has graduated from high school, for example, is another exception. So if someone is homeschooling their child and meeting the current homeschool requirements, they are not in violation of this statute. So therefore, this just doesn't apply.
Would you explain the fine, the citation difference in this?
Right. Under this, failure to comply, so what would happen is that a court, and it says may order, a variety of things, 1 through 6, they wouldn't have to order all of these.
Okay.
And then if someone does not comply with the court order is when the fine would kick in, and it's a $300 fine. And I know there's a question about imprisonment, and there's no imprisonment. For a violation, there is not imprisonment ever. And but then once someone had complied with the court order, there would be no fine. It also allows the court some discretion based on the ability of the person to pay. So it could be a lesser fine.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
I think that takes care of it.
Okay.
Cindy, I thank you very much for your expertise and help. With that, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 350.
Can I just hold this in
the Department of Ed signed up for the wrong bill.
Oh, they're out of here.
That was one of my dear headlights.
And I misspoke earlier. I intended to say that we were going to go to Senate Bill 372 next instead of 272. And so I'm going to reverse myself and go to Senate Bill 372. That opened a work session on Senate Bill 372. And we've had a lot of discussion about this bill, which involves a school district that's been one district for many years and now is struggling over how they might become two separate districts. I'm going to ask Don Marshall, John Witte, and Gary Fredrickson to come forward, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. I've had the honor, if you want to call it that, of trying to work with the folks from the Morrow County School District, as well as those folks representing the citizens of the IOWN attendance area of the Morrow School District. In their attempt to create two school districts out of one. I feel as though what I've been trying to do is to mediate the dissolution of a 45-year marriage. The Ione area has been a part of the Morrow County School District for that long, and they have now chosen to, in effect, secede. And so what we're trying to do is to create a process whereby they can accomplish that end while at the same time allowing the Morrow County School District Board to represent what they believe is in the best interests of all the citizens of Morrow County, as well as all of the students of Morrow County, both those that are currently in the school district and those that will be a part of the new school district. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to publicly thank you for your patience in allowing this process to proceed. I'd like to thank Chuck Bennett from COSA, Richard Kosazan, who's represented the Ione folks. I'd also like to thank John Osborne, the attorney for the Ione folks, as well as John Witte, the attorney for the Morrow School District, for their patience in moving a lot of faxes and documents and potential agreements and sometimes not potential agreements back and forth. I think at this point we're closer than we have ever been. There is a what I would call a memorandum of understanding that's circulating. There are still some relatively, I would term relatively minor details to be worked out, but I believe that if we can get to a level of agreement on that memorandum of understanding, then there are, I would guess, maybe 6 or 8 major components of that memorandum of understanding that will need to be in a bill. And I believe that we're just a matter of days away of coming to that agreement and agreeing on what the amendments to Senate Bill 372 should look like, and ready to come back to you with a bill that all the parties can agree to, and we can allow the folks in Ione to create their own school district for this upcoming school year, as well as allow the members of the Morrow County School Board to tell their citizens that they have worked out an agreement that's fair to both the taxpayers and the students, the Morrow County School District that are there now and those that won't be there when they become a part of the Ione School District. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll allow the chair of the Morrow County School Board, Mr. Fredrickson, and Mr. Witte, the attorney for the school board, to perhaps give you some perspective on the negotiations, where they are, and where we believe they'll be within a very short period of time. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Please.
Senator Starr and members of the committee, my name is John Witte, and as Mr. Marshall indicated, I'm an attorney and I represent the Morrow County School Board. And I think that Mr. Marshall did a fine job of summarizing what we've been trying to do and what we've been through to get to this point. It's one of those processes where when you begin and you face it, you don't even know what the questions are, and it certainly you have to identify those before you end up with the answers. And so we've tried to work through this, and I really feel like we have gotten to the point where we're very close to having an agreement with the folks in Ione and the school board in terms of how this separation, secession, if you want to call it that, will occur. Actually, it was yesterday that I drafted and put forward a revised memorandum of agreement that summarized what I thought was the basis of the agreement. And I think in the discussions we've had since then, generally speaking, there is agreement on all of the points. There are a couple where there's still some discussion, maybe some disagreements and things that need to be worked out. But I think we've come very close. It's been the board's position that they felt it was very important to know and identify and understand what the terms and conditions of this process and of this deal actually were before the board said, yes, we're on board with this, we're willing to go forward with this. And they felt like they had that obligation to the folks in Morrow County to make sure that this was a deal that they felt would be good for everybody before they agreed to it. And that's what we've been trying to work toward. And again, I think we're very close to that. So I agree with Mr. Marshall. I think it's just a matter of days before we are at a point where we can have a signed memo of agreement, then submit that, have the amendments or the bill modified such that it is consistent with that memo of agreement, and then present it to the committee.
Any questions? Thank you very much. This is real progress. I appreciate the hard work that's gone into it.
I would just like to make a correction. I'm Gary Fredrickson, and I'm vice chairman of the Morrow County School Board, not chairman. But I think it's important for you to know that we are very interested in moving this process forward, and that we have discussed most of the major items and have agreement on that. And we're very, very close, and everybody's moving forward in good faith. So we need one more meeting together with their committee and our committee, and then get our attorney's advice on make sure it's in everybody's best interest, because both committees are very concerned that it's fair and equitable, and it's complicated enough that if we don't have enough detail, we're very concerned that we could make a mistake, and none of us want to do that. And by the same token, you know, time is of the essence, and we have a lot of pressure on us to perform in a timely manner, because we have the next school budget year, and actually the Morrow County School Board would like their district to be formed so we can get done with that part, because with all the other issues that we have as a district, we have our hands full. But timing is the issue, and we need one more good, productive meeting. We've had some really good, frank discussion, but the detail is very, very important for both sides, and I just don't want to make some mistakes, because I feel that that we're very, very close.
Senator Perioli.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering, Mr. Chairman, if it would be possible to schedule the next meeting on this bill for a date certain.
I expect that could be arranged.
Okay, and that essentially would... we are under some time constraints as well, Mr. Chairman, and our Senate bill docket is supposed to be cleared by the 11th, and possibly with some special dispensation by the 14th. And we just don't want to see the 2.5 tons of bills from the House that are coming to this committee swamp us in our work to complete this important bill. So I just wanted the folks on the panel to know we're feeling some time pressure as well.
We've actually seen that schedule, and we know your workload, and we're very concerned that we get this done, and we can relate to that very well.
Mr. Chairman, I'll leave it to your able abilities.
Thank you, Senator Perioli. Would be my intention to move the bill in its final form, if possible, 1 week from today. If we're unable to do that, we'll move the bill through Ways and Means minus final form. But I'm hopeful that that gives you time to reach final resolution, so that we can draft the necessary amendments. Any other questions or comments? Thank you. Are there others who want to testify on the bill? If not, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 372. And would be open a public hearing on Senate Bill 272. And we have a number of folks signed up on 272. Is it Susan Merrill?
I might have Frank first.
I'll have Frank Bronner and Steve Cohen. and John Marshall come up first here.
I was about to take my name off. No, I'm not going to allow it.
Oh, now remember, John, this is my bill, so be careful with it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association, and I will take responsibility for the amendments to Senate Bill 272 as appear before you. I'd like to thank Senator Morissette for allowing us to use the bill on which he was the co-sponsor as a vehicle for this issue, and I apologize for bringing it to you late. I believe there was an understanding that this issue would have been brought to you in a pre-session filed bill, but that did not happen. And it's an important issue and then one that we wanted to bring to your attention. And I thank you, Senator Morissette, again for allowing us to use your bill as a vehicle. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing us to present the issue. The Fair Dismissal Appeals Board is an entity inside the Department of Education. It's created by statute, and it consists of 20 members appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. And the purpose of the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board is to serve as the first avenue of appeal for a teacher that has been dismissed. The Dismissal Appeals Board consists of 5 individuals who are teachers, 5 individuals that are school board members, 5 individuals that are school administrators, and 5 members of the public. And if a teacher is dismissed and he or she chooses to appeal that dismissal, they first go to the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board, where a 3-member panel is seated to hear both sides and then make a decision, if the either upholding the decision of the school district board or the decision of or to overturn that decision. If a teacher is still dissatisfied or the board is dissatisfied with that decision, then their next avenue is the Court of Appeals. So that, in a nutshell, is the purpose and the makeup of the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board. Second, we have the Oregon Youth Authority. And this is the entity, of course, that provides for facilities that incarcerate juvenile offenders. The educational program in the Oregon Youth Authority facilities is provided by school districts, or ESDs, under contract through the Department of Education. A portion of the state school fund is allocated to the Department of Education for the specific purpose of purchasing the education program in these facilities. The Department of Education then in turn contracts with school districts or ESDs to provide those educational services. What we have at issue is how we deal with considerations of teachers that have in those facilities, those OYA facilities that have been dismissed, and the teacher appeals that dismissal. The Fair Dismissal Appeals Board then sits down to review that dismissal and what kind of avenue they have to student records that are in the possession of the Oregon Youth Authority. And with that bit of background, I'll allow Mr. Bronner to give you the perspective of the issue and the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board's concern relative to how they consider a dismissal and why the amendments or this bill is very important.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Frank Bronner. I am retired and I reside at 5645 Odin Way in Nesquen. It's good to see all of you again. Joining me is Stephen Crone, Assistant Attorney General, who is here to respond to legal or historic questions you may have. Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, I am a member of the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board. I have been since 1998. The Fair Dismissal Appeals Board unanimously endorsed the amendments that have been prepared by Legislative Council, which are before you and are proposed to become Senate Bill 272. We thank you, Senator Morissette, for the vehicle. We apologize to you for this delay. It should have been pre-session filed. There was a change in administration, as you know, at the Department of Education. I don't know which cracks it fell through, and I apologize for it being late. Doesn't mean that it's not an important issue. Since 1975, the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board has heard appeals from teachers and administrators who have been dismissed by school boards. It has saved money, saved time, and been fair. The board consists of 20 members, and you've heard the makeup of those 20 members. The goal is for cases to be decided by persons knowledgeable with the workings of public education and have an understanding of the process of human resources, and we want a meaningful and fair process to exist. Typically, in an average year, there are 6 cases. We've had a couple more in recent years, but 6-8 cases are heard each year. Cases are heard by this 3-member panel consisting of a member of the public. I am a public member, by the way, even though I'm a former school board member, and a school board member, and either a teacher or administrator. The panel must review the dismissal decision, and the statute clearly sets forth the timelines by which this decision has to be rendered. This is not something you set on and let time lapse. We have certain timelines by which we must respond. The panel must hear all the evidence to decide whether the statutory grounds allowing dismissal have been met. The panel must submit a detailed opinion addressing the evidence through findings of fact and the law through conclusions of the law. The decision by the panel can be appealed, and obviously we want to build the facts in the event it is appealed to the Oregon Court of Appeals. Since creation, 75, there's been 75 to 80 formal opinions by the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board from all the appeals filed throughout the state of Oregon. The hearing process before the panel allows the dismissed employee to contest the evidence to make the dismissal decision and requires the school district to prove the facts and the charges that it made in dismissing the employee. You can summarize that next paragraph in my testimony by saying it's all about due process for the district and for the employee. Oregon law is very specific about what is required. It is important that the employee have access to the evidence used in making the decision for dismissal. It is equally important for the school district employer to have access to the evidence it needs to make the correct decision and support that decision by the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board. It's a formal process. It typically takes 3-4 days, but sometimes has gone 10-12 days. I agreed to serve as a volunteer on this board because I believed I had the experience that would be helpful. I'm a former school board member, former chairman of a metropolitan school board. I've been a director of a human resource department with 300 employees, and I've obviously spent 19 sessions in this building and 18 special sessions, which does give you some qualifications. The FTAB members are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, and I was confirmed by you. I'm very impressed with the motivation and the dedication of my colleagues on that panel. We have some wonderful people that are all volunteers that give of their time to see that this process moves forward. We want to ensure that fair is the goal. Well, when we see a problem, we react and we see a problem. I and my colleagues are pleased that school districts and school teachers enter into contracts to teach youth in the OYA facilities. In the past year, we've heard 2 cases dealing with teachers in such facilities. We found it difficult to achieve our goal of being fair, or maybe better stated, we were unsure of our conclusion. We didn't have all the facts. The passage of this bill would address our concern. We need to determine those facts. We need testimony. Recently, not only were we denied certain records, several witnesses declined to testify based on that same decision to refuse pertinent records availability. Our process is to find fairly between the school district and the administrator or the teacher. We're not interested in the records of a youth. unless they pertain to the case. These amendments are tightly drawn, in our opinion. There's no fishing expedition possible. Testimony in front of our panel is sworn, and the process is not public unless the parties wish it to be. I'm proud of the role we play in solving disputes. I think school districts and teachers that have been through the process would salute us for our effort. I believe we bend over backwards to ensure that both parties are heard and the facts for the record are complete in the event there is an appeal. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the adoption of these amendments will ensure that we can do our job correctly and efficiently, and it will not, in our opinion, infringe on the privacy rights of anyone. Now, we'd be happy to respond to your questions. I'd like Steve Krohn to talk. I've asked him to talk to you. We have a case under appeal, which we cannot go through all the ramifications, but I wanted to give you a flavor of what we're talking about. It is limited as to what we're talking about. And Steve, if you'd be kind enough to just talk to us about some of the things that would help us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Krohn. I'm an assistant attorney general, and for about the last 10 years, one of my assignments has been to provide legal advice to the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board. I would like the committee to know that I applaud the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board because they're all volunteers, and it's been I've really enjoyed working with a group of citizens who've come forward on their own time to hear cases, and I want the legislature to know that. In terms of specifics, we had a case in which Mr. Bronner was a panel chair of a three-member panel down in Southern Oregon, and I wanted to read three questions and answers from a transcript so you would understand what Mr. Bronner was confronted as he was conducting the hearing. I was also there to provide legal advice. The basic issue was that there was a teacher and then there was a youth at the facility, and the youth made allegations against the teacher which were very serious. And so because as in most situations like this there's not third party observers, it was a question of whether to believe the youth or believe the teacher. And the school district made a decision, and then it resulted in a hearing because the teacher appealed. When the one of the members of the facility was called as a witness, he answered two questions, and then I would want to point out the third question, how he responded. When he was asked by the counsel for the teacher, this says his history, this meaning the youth, of going to great lengths, setting up situations to groom. Grooming is the behavior that he exhibits, correct? And the employee answered, correct. The second question was, and violating boundaries is a behavior he exhibits, correct? And the employee answered, that'd be correct. And then the union attorney shifted gears because he wanted to find out something else that may have impeached this particular youth. And he said, has he demonstrated a tendency to lie on the facility? Answer, I'm not going to answer that. And this was what led to, and this happened with a series of witnesses who, not out of bad faith, but because they were trying to figure out whether or not the information they provided came from the youth records, would, I'll use the term sporadically, decide not to answer certain questions. The Fair Dismissal Appeals Board is not here as an advocate. This situation could equally affect a school district in a reverse situation. It is also not uncommon in state government. A minor role I have is representing FDAB. I'm a member of the Labor and Employment Section of the Department of Justice. I've been there for about 15 years, and we regularly advise state employers as they make decisions with other employees, state employees, that also have a property interest, due process of law. And we've always had to balance the confidentiality of records with the due process right of an employee not to be terminated without due process of law, if you will. And so this is an example of what they're trying to do is balance and keep the records tightly controlled, but to allow access as either party would need them, whether it be a school district or in the particular example I read you, whether the counsel for a teacher may want some information. I'd be happy to answer questions. That's the example I have.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this afternoon, I met with the director of the Oregon Youth Authority. I enjoyed that meeting and our discussion. I believe that common sense would dictate that somehow we can solve this. if we fail to solve it, people will not have due process, and we do not have any desire to get into records we shouldn't get into, but we do have a desire to treat the people that come before us fairly. And so I know where we are in the sessions, and this bill should have been before you in January. I believe that with your leadership, sir, we might be able to craft something that would at least begin to address it. We either fix it now, or you'll fix it 2 years from now. It is broke. You cannot have the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board operating with one hand tied behind them. I urge you to adopt Senate Bills 272 with our amendments, or with amendments to the amendments, if we can work something out.
May I ask? Senator Marcet?
Mr. Crone. Thank you, Senator.
I'm kind of curious about the kind of information you might find in a student's file in those circumstances. Would it be anecdotal reports dealing with the teacher, dealing with the principal about truthfulness and so on? What kind of records would you be looking at?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Morissette, what would drive this is what kind of information did the employer use, was made available to the employer in making a decision, for example. And so the process would be if there's something about an interaction between a teacher and a youth that led to a decision, and then is there anything in the records of the youth that are pertinent to that? For example, would the youth have talked about it in another setting? There may be other information that would be pertinent, but it would only be dependent upon how the decision was formulated by the employer. And if they didn't rely on any records and there was nothing there, then it wouldn't be necessary. It would be unlikely that the records would be, and the process is set up in this bill not to make them available. Only when it becomes pertinent because the employer has moved based upon an interaction with this student, for example.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, you're in a corporation, and you dismiss someone, and that someone goes to court, and you have to produce records. It would depend upon the circumstance. Yeah. Maybe he was tardy 10 days out of 11. Who knows? But you would have to have those kind of records that came to your attention in order to produce it in front of the court. Here we sat as sort of the interim, but we have judicial authority, and we are there. It's an official thing, and we're trying to find the facts. Now, we subpoenaed, I was chair, and I subpoenaed records. We keep saying records. We don't want records or files. We know specific what we're asking for, and maybe we should somehow narrow this to where we have to list what we're asking for. We don't want to fish. But if it comes to our attention, then perhaps we can move ahead on that. But I subpoenaed, and the court said no. Now, the point of it is, the court said, rightly or wrongly, that unless the statute was changed, even if OIA permitted us to have the records, we couldn't have them.
Okay. May I just ask? Okay. Yeah. Let's say in a particular circumstance, and the case circumstance has parameters, it's limited, and then, for instance, could you, as a compromise, would you ask if there are certain things in the record? Okay, you would ask a series of questions about, and if there was something in the record, that question would have to be responded to. Would that be fishing or not fishing? You would try to narrow it.
What would happen, Senator, is that under this proposed language, uh-huh, the party requesting the records has to make a basic showing that there's something there and it's relevant, as I recall the language of the statute. So that's a threshold. They have to make a showing before they can gain access. And then the access is limited to the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board. And in the process, all the interested parties, for example, OIA, are given notice that that something is being requested and the basis of that request so that they can come in and take a position before an individual panel.
Let me try one more time.
I'm sorry.
No. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I was trying to narrow it. If you would ask a question within the scope of the case, and if there was something in the student's record that was within that scope, you might gain access to that, but you wouldn't gain access to everything else in the student's record. Is that right?
Yes, sir. That is correct.
From a practical standpoint, would work.
Good. So you would narrow the scope of your request. So you wouldn't look at the entire record. You would only find out.
We have no desire to do that.
And
I understand that we're talking about a new relationship. It's a profitable relationship for Oregon to have these young people receive their education. We certainly commend that. But the problem is we've had two cases, and in both cases we had difficulty. Some of the questions are pretty simple. But they come to us, and we want to say, well, was the school district right, or is the teacher right, and how can we determine that?
Hey, as a teacher, I want to protect the rights of the teachers. I mean, against false accusations or whatever, and I would be interested in knowing if there was some vindication somewhere in a record that it was a false accusation. I mean, also protect the student at the same time. So I understand what you're getting at.
I don't want to belabor, but we subpoenaed the youth in question. Because we, out of frustration, we couldn't get anywhere else.
Yeah.
And the youth sat before us and was sworn in. And the youth denied answering the questions for the same decision that we were denied the record.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Well, Senator Ferriola, you have questions?
I do.
Folks, please step back down here.
Mr. Chairman, thanks very much. I have just a whole bunch of questions, and they're actually process questions. They may not be answerable today. With your permission, Mr. Chairman. First of all, the bill summary may overstate what this bill actually does, because it says that requires any record submitted to the Fair Dismissal Appeals not be copied. And for me, it's going to be a practical impossibility to have a group of people meeting and not have copies of the records for them to follow during the proceedings. So, you know, that may just be an inconsistency between the bill summary and what the amendments actually say. On page 4 of the amendment...
Excuse me, but
yes,
you are correct in your assumption.
Thank you. On page 4, and I think this follows along with Senator Morissette's concern, is there any mechanism that the commission itself will have to limit the disclosure of records to issues that are germane? Because the bill says records and other documents. So I'm assuming that if you subpoena the file, you're going to get it all. Is there any mechanism that you can use to be very specific about the type of material that you want that, in fact, informs the question before the board and limits your subpoena to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, on line 15, on page 4, you do get some limitation. But here's what is intended. What we want is the specific information dealing with a specific issue. We do not want a file. We do not want everything for the last 10 years. We want the specific response to what has come to our attention.
Mr. Chairman, the bill says history and prognosis, which is about as broad a descriptor as you could get.
And that's one of the things we talked about today to try to tighten. We have no intention of doing anything other than finding the facts that are pertinent to the case.
Mr. Chairman, a question on what happens to copies of the records that will be made. This is on page 5C. No copies of the record be made except for use as exhibit during the hearings, and that at the conclusion of the hearing process, all records except those used as exhibits be returned, which means that those copies that are used as exhibits will be retained. Now, I understand they'll be retained under seal, that they'll be retained at the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board. But I cannot imagine a situation where the appellant's attorney would not retain a file copy. And I'm curious about If all the records are returned to the custodian, will all copies of the records be numbered? If people are going to have to sign a non-disclosure agreement, will those copies in somehow be crash numbered, or will there be some kind of a receipt so that when, at the end of the hearing, all the copies except those that are particular to this issue, will they all be returned back to the custodian agent, which in this case would be the Fair Dismissal Board? And is there going to have to be an exception made to that return rule for the attorney representing the appellant who may seek further or may have further recourse?
You want to respond?
I think there's a number of questions there.
Yeah. Okay. You know what, I think, Mr. Chairman, it'd be very helpful is if maybe if we could have a representation of the document flow on a flow chart, so that at the end of the day, they all end up back at either the Fair Dismissal Board or the original records keeper.
Part of our statutory mission, Senator, is to provide the record that could be accessed by the appeals court if we go to appeal.
And you're under the obligation to do that. I understand.
And that's part of the reason there is a Fair Dismissal Appeals Board, is to reduce the expense. But your other questions, I think, are the areas where I think we can come to conclusions. We have no idea, we have no motivation to have more than what, and we have eight instances in the case that I can't go into detail because it's under appeal, but we had eight instances and then we gave up. We didn't go any further. There was probably maybe 15 instances where we needed some assistance. Most of those eight could be handled with verbal testimony from OYA. There were three or four that we wanted them to check their records to find out if this statement was fact. We get a statement from the school board, and we want to know, is that the way it was?
Mr. Chairman, my last question has to do with Mr. Bronner's testimony on page 5. Testimony in front of our panel is sworn, and the process is not public unless the parties wish it to be. And, Mr. Chairman, I'm concerned that... that there may be a strategic value to having those proceedings forced to become public. And I just was curious to know if there was a way creating a partition between that portion of the public hearing that would delve into records that would be otherwise unavailable to the public under any circumstances except with specific statutory authority. And I guess I'm referring to something like an executive session. Is there any mechanism to keep this proceeding from disclosing confidential information because the appellant asserts the right to have the hearing in public?
Mr. Chair and Senator Farioli, I would be hesitant to provide a blanket answer to that without doing research. That is a legitimate question. I don't think it'd be the same as, let's say, under the public records law, an executive session, but it could be explored.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is a very difficult issue of balance, balancing the rights of the individuals here, balancing the rights of the appellant. And I'm grateful that anybody would undertake to try to balance those issues. So the Fair Dismissal Board has a very tough job ahead of it. And I think we need to be diligent in trying to provide the assurances of protection of confidentiality for the youth and other parties that might be affected. And I have confidence that Mr. Bronner and the other members of the board will try to do that. But we need to ask about, you know, once these birds fly, they're hard to get back into the coop, and information's easy to transmit and duplicate and very difficult to retrieve once you've done that. And so I'm hoping that we can see some kind of just a walkthrough of how documents will circulate and then return back to the confidentiality. Last question, Mr. Chair. Is there a penalty for violation of confidentiality requirements on disclosure, intentional or otherwise?
Senator, under the proposed legislation, there is not, unless we check the end of the particular chapter. Oftentimes, the end of the ORS chapters, there's provisions about penalties if you violate, but I didn't check that. I apologize in advance, so I don't know the answer for certain.
But the proceedings themselves and the records that we develop
the panel members are sworn to secrecy. Let me just one quick comment on public on having public meetings. I would hate to, and I subscribe to public meetings, have all my life. But in this particular case, if the appellant, you could discourage them from coming forward if they felt, particularly in a small town, in some of the environments that we've operated in, they might find that they don't want to come and tell their story if it's going to be on the front page of the XYZ News.
Oh, absolutely, Mr. Chairman. I understand what Mr. Brown is referring to. What I'm suggesting is on the other side of that coin, there are some folks that would want to force this issue into public. And let me give you an example. It has nothing to do with the case in front of you. In cases of national security, the defendant will often require the identification of witnesses in order to preclude prosecution. It's been very effective. And so there are settlement deals that are cut simply because the security agencies refuse to identify sources that may be undercover. That isn't a perfect example here, but there are strategic situations where people want to force a hearing into the public. There may be a legitimate reason to do that in this case. And I'm just concerned that if that is the case, if the appellant has an absolute right to a public hearing, that this panel explore an opportunity to partition that portion of the hearing that would disclose otherwise confidential information. And maybe there is. If there is, we should look at it.
Mr. Chair, I'm hopeful that we can continue the conversation we started this afternoon with OIA. I'm hopeful that you might be able to give us a couple, three. I understand where you're at, timeline. I wish it was January. I wish it was when it was supposed to be here. I will tell you this, that if there are further cases dealing with the OIA under the existing circumstance, we're going to have a very difficult time of rendering due process. That's what it's all about. So maybe we have to do something temporary until we get to next sessions where we can address some of these other issues, which are very important to us. But on behalf of the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board, I thank you for your time and urge and thank John Marshall for helping us and Senator Morsak for providing the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I think the Fair Dismissal Board is fortunate to have Mr. Bronner assist in this process.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Farioli, and I agree. Appreciate this testimony this afternoon. We've got several others signed up on this bill. Time is running, and Karen Brazel, Nancy Miller,
members of the committee, and Mr. Chair, I'm Karen Brazeau. I'm the director of the Oregon Youth Authority, and I am passing out written testimony, but I will just talk briefly. And first, I would like to tell you that my background is in education, and how I came to become the director of the Youth Authority is first, I was an associate superintendent at the Department of Education and had in my division the education programs in the youth correctional facilities. So I really come to this through the educational world and have a great deal of respect for the Fair Dismissals and Appeals Board. And as Mr. Bronner said, I did meet with him this afternoon, and I regret that I was not aware of his concerns earlier. He did call me on Monday, and we traded calls, and the first time we were able to get together was this afternoon. And I do understand his concerns in relation to how the Fair Dismissals and Appeals Board interacts with the school districts that contract to provide education services in the youth correctional facilities. It's a relatively new arrangement, being that the Youth Authority itself is fairly new, and to have local school districts and education service districts providing those services in those facilities has only been going on, I think, for about the last 4 or 5 years. And to date, there's only been 2 instances in which the board has been involved, and only one of those instances, the one that you heard about, involved OYA staff. So I wanted to tell you that to give you a context. These are not huge problems given the number of kids that we serve and the really great success that we've had in having local public schools work in our facilities. And so I'm very committed to try to maintain the overall success of that program. I will tell you that the amendments, I do not believe, will get the board where they want to go. Further, they're overly broad, and as my written testimony says, they really begin to open the door and crack the very foundations for the protection of youth records, and not just juvenile offender records, but the very basis of access to youth records. And some of the very questions that Senator Ferrioli brought up, I think you'll hear from other people, cause a great deal of concern among those of us who work with youth and youth offenders, and therefore there's a great deal of opposition to the to this particular strategy to try to get at the issues that you heard from Mr. Browner. And I am very open to working with him and the board members to try to deal more specifically with his particular issues. I also feel like I must bring to your attention that I am not here with the Youth Authority's representative from the Department of Justice. Neither is Department of Human Services here with their representative from the Department of Justice. It was my understanding that the Department of Justice, because they represent all of these agencies, including the board, that they were still looking at this issue, and that it was had not taken decided what their position would be, and that Mr. Crone's appearance before you today really took me by surprise. My understanding is that he's on vacation, and so if he's how he represented himself to you is a mystery to me. So I'll have to figure that one out later, but his description of the case, that there was an OYA involvement with the board, I just have to tell you, it was fairly appalling, and it is not exactly how it happened. And had the Department of Justice attorney who represents the Youth Authority been here, she would have given you a different story on that case. So there's always two sides to cases that end up being at issue. Because that case is an appeal, there's probably enough said about that. But I want to close just again in saying I'm very sympathetic with some of the problems that the board finds itself at working in a new situation inside a closed custody facility, and would be happy to try to figure out how we can address those. This amendment, it has too many problems and is not the way to go.
Is this a issue that can be addressed in a timely fashion, like in the next week, or is this something that you...
If it can be adequately addressed, that those are two separate questions. Can it be done adequately first? Is there a solution? And so, can it be done in a timely fashion before we run out of time? I mean, this...
Mr. Chair and Senator Morissette, I don't know, because I really just learned about really the basis for the issues a few hours ago. It's quite possible that there are some other statutory limitations that would have to be addressed. Even so, I would ask you to consider the balance again, the balance that is trying to be struck here, and the fact that in the years that we've had these programs working, that there's been one incident where this has been a problem. The judge who denied access, that there was a judge that denied the records to access to the records to the board, that could have been appealed and was not. So there is a method in existing law that was not acted upon. So rather than go forward with something that I think you'll hear a lot of reasons for not to move on, to try to fix something that has problems but isn't totally broken, I think it's kind of an overcorrection.
Okay. In for the sake of due process for the person who is accused by a student, say, there is an appeals process that is available outside of...
Yes.
Okay.
Currently is under appeal. That's what I heard.
Yes, this particular case is under appeal.
Well, we're running well beyond the time I had allotted for this hearing on this bill. I had hoped that we could handle it in less than a half hour and that we would be able to get on and provide plenty of time for the folks that have hearings on other bills here. So we're going to continue, but please be brief. What I feel at this moment is that this bill is going nowhere unless there is opportunity to work toward a solution outside of the hearing process. We're not going to solve it in committee. So, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Nancy Miller. I'm the Director of the Court Programs and Services Division of the State Court Administrator's Office, and I will be very brief. The records that are sought by this amendment are not OIA records. They are court records. This amendment is drafted so broadly as to include child abuse and neglect records. A child in the context of this statute is a term of art, and that is a child who is within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court for abuse and neglect. These records contain phenomenally sensitive information about parents, because very often the issue is whether children can return home to their parents, even with a youth or a youth offender. The issue is sometimes whether they can go home. So these records are not the records, I don't think, from hearing this today, that the proponents seek. We didn't hear about this until today, so I'm sorry I don't have written testimony, but if the proponents would like to talk to us further, we'd be happy to. I think this is extremely dangerous and overbroad.
Thank you very much. We have two other persons signed up. Susan Russell and Warren Olstead. Susan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I'm also speaking on behalf of the Juvenile Rights Project today, and we're here in opposition to this amendment. We have serious concerns that have been addressed in briefly by Ms. Miller in terms of the highly sensitive material that these records contain. These records, some of these records will go back to the youth's birth. If the court became involved in a dependency proceeding, the records may be voluminous. They may involve a documented history of physical or sexual abuse of the youth's siblings. There would be psychological evaluations of the youth throughout his or her upbringing, the youth's parents. There may be documentations about drug and alcohol problems and treatment that the youth parents or other family members participated in. The amendment here provides that the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board panel and counsel may make an in-camera inspection of the records before the subpoena is issued. And I just wanted to point out that that's quite a bit different than when we're talking about a criminal case, which I've had a lot of experience in dealing with the limitations or having access to records where they may be relevant in a criminal prosecution in defending a defendant. In that context, it's not a discretionary may, that, meaning that that the board may review the records before a subpoena is issued. If the subpoena is issued, then the parties have direct access. These records are recognized in the criminal courts by the judiciary as being very, very sensitive. An in-camera review under all circumstances is conducted by the court, and often many, many, many of the records are sealed and not released to the parties under any circumstances because they are not relevant to the criminal defense or the criminal prosecution. And I would submit that these are sort of a similar, they're not a criminal at this point, it's a dismissal, but they are sort of similar allegations that arise in those contexts. And so I just wanted to bring to the committee's attention that when dealing with sort of in a more serious context in a criminal prosecution, there are much higher standards in terms of protections of the privacy of these records and the sensitivity of the documents. Thank you for the opportunity to be heard.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Oren Bolstad. I'm a psychologist. Included in my practice, I consult at Oregon Youth Authority, where I conduct treatment and treatment groups with youth who have committed violent offenses, sex offenses, and any variety of different kinds of serious offenses. The most central critical aspect of providing treatment for these youngsters is building trust. These kids often come to us with a very suspicious nature. They don't trust adult authority figures, and it's a complicated and difficult process. We necessarily must begin our relationship by explaining to these youth that there are exceptions to confidentiality. For instance, if they report to us that they have abused a child, we're required to report that. If they tell us that they present immediate harm or a risk of danger to another person, we're going to have to report that as well. These are exceptions to confidentiality. I think these exceptions complicate building trust with these youth, but nonetheless, I think most of these youth can understand the reasons why we would break confidentiality in those circumstances. I think they're understandable, and I think the youth find them reasonable. Mr. Chairman, I'd find it very difficult to be put in a situation where I had to explain to a youth that there's another exception to confidentiality, and that exception is that there's a need for a Fair Dismissal Appeals Board to have license to go on a fishing expedition in your chart to uncover whatever they might want to uncover, which could confirm or disconfirm that you have a history of lying. Parenthetically, most youth in the Oregon Youth Authority have histories of lying. I think that this is a wholly unnecessary, overly broad imposition on confidentiality, and it's a tremendous negative influence on trying to build trust or provide treatment. I'm also concerned about what I consider to be a general erosion of privacy in this country. We've seen many examples of that raised by recent trends in internet information, access to Social Security, et cetera, et cetera. I worry that at some point we need to have discipline and a strong sense of ethics about these issues. If we believe in treatment, if we believe in trying to help these youth, then I think it's necessary that we protect their privacy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that you would keep your testimony brief. We're going to close the public hearing on 272, and we're going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 849 and simultaneously 850, because several have signed up for both bills. I will ask that you speak to the bill individually, but that you, when you're at the witness table, that you might speak to both bills. With that, we're going to open these public hearing on Senate Bill 849-850. As a subcommittee of the Education Committee, come on forward. Tom Seward. And we have We've got the sponsor of the bill, of the bills, Margaret DeLacy. If you come forward, we're going to allow you first opportunity. Tell us about your bills.
Do you want me to begin?
Yes, please. Introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Senator Starr, members of the committee. My name is Margaret DeLacy. I'm the parent of three children. I live in Portland, and I'm a member of the board of the Oregon Association for Talented and Gifted. I am distributing to you copies of my testimony, a packet of documents in the order in which they're referred to in the testimony that I would like to be giving, which I'm going to abbreviate today, and a further set of documents. I believe you'll have tag expenditures by districts and by the state of Oregon. I was offering to share this with somebody else today, and this fell out of my notebook by mistake. It was a mistake that my copier made. Right now, for 100 districts, this is what we have. We have zero funding for 100 districts in our state right now for tag services. I had planned to start with some general comments on talented and gifted students and their needs. I'm not going to go through those in any details. I would just like to point out that gifted education is not elitist, that TAG students do not learn by their own devices. They don't teach themselves. That programs are very important to their success in school and in life. That our failure to provide appropriate services places those students at risk, and that providing services to these students has been shown to do no harm and cause no problems for other students. Now, I'd like to take the two bills in order and speak about one at a time. With regard to House Bill 849, I don't want to go into huge detail about the need of students for instruction. I think it's obvious to all of us that if students are going to learn something, they need to be taught something, and that that's just as true for gifted students as it is for any other student. That's why we have violin teachers. That's why we have sports coaches. That's why we have selective universities, which accept these students because they recognize that these students also need to learn if they're going to be contributing to society. I'd like to point out to you that funding in the state for TAG services has dropped steadily and consistently over a decade, and that we are not close to the level that's provided in other reporting states. The average reporting state reported an expenditure for TAG services of $239 per student. We're at 1% of that. In the last biennium, we were providing about $2 per student. I think it was $2.40 per student. This year, the governor's budget will be eliminating all funding, all state funding for gifted students. And as you've seen, many of the districts are not providing services either. The Department of Education has not been giving the attention to TAG that I believe is deserved by the size of the student population. We have about 46,000 TAG students in our state. For comparison, we have about 70,000 special education students. And I would also like to point out, with regard to 849, that many of our business groups believe that if students simply meet benchmarks and standards, that we've done a good job. Most of our TAG students exceed these standards long before they leave school. And we must provide services. The Education Act for the 21st Century promised that we would provide services for students who exceed standards. Right now, many of our districts are not providing adequate educational services for these students, and as a result, many of these students are spending years in classrooms not learning anymore. This is a tremendous waste of economic opportunity for our students and for our state, and it places these students at risk of all kinds of social and emotional as well as educational problems. Now I'd like to turn to Senate Bill 850. That bill provides funding for advanced placement instruction for these students. Currently, the state of Oregon is in receipt of a federal grant that provides for advanced placement services. That grant is something that the state is administering as a subcontractor for a consortium of Western states. We are in our third year of that grant, and it is ending this year. There's absolutely no insurance that we will be able to regain that money through an application process. I know the state plans to try, and right now we are tied for 40th place among the states in our level of participation in the Advanced Placement Program. The Advanced Placement Program and the Third International Math and Science Study, TIMSS, have done studies of how effective these programs are, and they found that students who participate in Advanced Placement Programs are much more likely to go on to math, science, engineering, and medical careers. That they're much, there's been research by the Federal Department of Education that shows that students who have access to rigorous high school education are much more likely to graduate from college than students identified by any other criterion, including socioeconomic status, for example. The rigor of high school classes is the single most important factor that they can identify in whether a student will be successful in college. If we want to have some of these economic programs in our state that are dependent on higher education, we have to prepare students to participate in them. Right now, we're not doing a very good job of this compared with other states or compared with other countries, and we simply must do something about this as a state. We feel that this is an economic development issue. We're recommending that this money come out of general funds and be found within the economic development budget. And I think I'll end there. I've spoken as fast as I can. Oh, no, there's one more thing that I do need to say, which is that if the committee's interested in this bill, we do recommend an amendment that would make it possible for advanced placement money to be applied to equipment as well as to training staff and providing curriculum and exam fees. The reason for that is that we've heard that the federal grant does not provide for equipment purchases, and there are schools where they have trained staff, eager students, funding for the fees, that they're not able to offer the classes for one of a couple hundred dollars that they can spend on the equipment. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was Saturday Night Live. Whoever it was, I commend you.
Yes, Bob.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Seward. I'm with the Oregon Department of Education and work with both the Office of Curriculum Instruction and Field Services and the Office of Special Education. And I don't usually recite bona fides when I come up here, but I want to just say that for 17 years I was the TAG specialist for the Department of Education. I was the first president of the statewide association for talented and gifted OTAG, and have been a longstanding supporter of programs for bright children in our schools. And so I come to this podium with sort of a mixed feeling about the sentences I'm going to say about 849, but I'm compelled to say them because the bill as it's written would put the state of Oregon in jeopardy about the use of federal funds. 849, the department would oppose for a very specific reason. It's a technical reason, or at least a policy reason. Title 2A is the highly qualified teachers section of the No Child Left Behind bill, or Act. It provides funds to local school districts for a variety of purposes, many purposes, in fact, that focus around staff development to increase teacher quality and working with kids in schools and improving students' performance in schools. The Title IIA requirements, however, does not give the state authority to tell the districts how much money to spend on what priorities. As you may know from other hearings around No Child Left Behind, you know that many of the accountability requirements imposed by No Child Left Behind really is accountability at the local level. It's accountability that school districts and schools need to address in their efforts to meet the standards for students. And the state has no voice in how the districts may approach teacher training and expenditure of funds and improving student performance. This is one of those parts of the law where the state has no authority to direct the district to spend money on any particular area, and particularly around talented and gifted. So we don't have the authority to say to a district, you must spend some portion of your grant that would add up to the $1.5 million spoken to in this bill. We just can't tell them that under the auspices of the law. And I will provide you with some information and analysis that the federal government has provided that specifically addresses that particular issue in the district's, the state's authority and lack of authority in particular areas. We do have the authority to set state priorities. We don't have the authority to not approve a grant because the particular district doesn't address those state priorities. We do have the authority to ask districts to identify needs that the district has in their application under Title IIA. We don't have the ability to disapprove an application because the district doesn't address the needs that they've identified themselves or all of those needs. So we are very, very limited in the way that we can direct school districts to direct their own dollars through Title IIA grants to particular populations, particular programs, particular trainings for teachers. However, I must admit that the Department of Education in my office, Curriculum Instruction and Field Services, hasn't done probably the best job in developing a Title IIA application that emphasizes the district's responsibility to address the needs of special populations, and that would include special education and other special needs kids, including talented and gifted. And we do expect, and the law requires, that districts do identify the needs of those kids and how they may address them in the use of the Title IIA funds, and we will be improving that in the next grant round application for school districts. That's my testimony on 849. 850, I applaud AP programs and supporting AP programs. It is one of it adds vitality to a high school's curriculum. It is one of the first programs that erodes when financial burdens or financial problems occur in state funding. We have seen erosion in AP programs statewide. We do have a WICHE grant, as Margaret mentioned, which is not a great amount of money, but it is some support for AP programs. However, it does target rural school districts and districts of high poverty. So we have a large number of districts in the state of Oregon that doesn't receive benefit out of the AP, those AP grants that we get from the federal government. These funds, if we were able to receive the $550,000, we could target to the districts that aren't eligible under the WICHE grant, districts that are average income districts or don't have high poverty levels or are not rural. And by the way, that's where we see the most erosion at this point. We're able to support AP in many of the districts that we can use the WICHE money for. It's the rest of the districts where we see more erosion occurring, and we need to really help prop those programs up. So we support the idea of the AP program. I know that it means additional dollars, and that's certainly going to be a discussion point, but I can't help but believe that this is an important consideration for education of children in the state. Thank you.
Questions? I don't have a question, but I am very supportive of the effort, and I hope we can find a way to do something, because I think to get rid of the talent and gifted program for the reasons you mentioned, it's terrible. I mean, we are selling our kids short, and I know a lot of the rural school districts, the small schools, are eliminating those programs as they're eliminating other kinds of things, and I just truly hope that we can do something.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Margaret and I, and we've actually known each other for many years, had a meeting earlier today to talk about what steps the department can take that wouldn't cost a lot of money but would improve the system for finding out about kids and what's going on with those kids in schools. And the department has agreed to take many of the steps that we talked about. We will be improving our system and so that we know more about the kids and what's going on with them. That's at least a step that we can take that won't cost the state a lot of money, but will really improve what we know about kids and what we're doing with kids in schools.
That's important. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, may I thank you for holding this hearing. We're very grateful. And I would just like to say I did meet with Bob today, and I think we're both in agreement also that some additional resources are going to be very important to do a good job with this.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have several other people signed up. Going to invite some citizens up before I invite the Department of Ed up. Any further?
Mr. Chair, I did bring several members of my staff in case you had any detailed questions. So unless you have some detailed questions, they would prefer not to testify at this time.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's helpful. Robin Pope. And Deb Andrews. Senator Brown is not arrived. She's still in committee. Okay.
Is it all right if this young gentleman comes up too? He's here to testify.
This young gentleman.
Yes.
We will permit that.
Thank you.
able to testify briefly.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Chairman Starr, members of the committee, my name is Robin Pope, and today I'm here wearing the hat of a mom of a talented and gifted student who attends school in the Beaverton School District. And you have my written testimony. I believe it's being distributed. My son has been in the Beaverton schools since kindergarten. He's now 13 and in seventh grade and has been in TAG programs since first grade. And I would like to stress the necessity for this state to provide funding to train teachers. The difference between teachers who've been exposed to issues regarding gifted children and provided with strategies for teaching them in the regular classroom makes an incredible difference to every one of the students, and not just the gifted students, interestingly enough, but to every student in their classroom, because many of the teaching strategies that work for gifted students work for all students. It's been fascinating to watch that. And I just want to personalize it a little bit today. My son asked me to come today. I told him I had a chance to come down, but I was busy, and I was coming tomorrow for another hearing. And he said, please go, and please tell them that it's really important that we have teachers who can teach us and teach us at differentiated levels, provide us with challenging materials, and meet our needs. And that may sound like he's talking like a grown-up, and a lot of gifted students do that. They think differently, they learn differently, they feel differently, and they have special needs. And it's interesting, we think of special needs students typically as students with some kind of learning disability or physical disability. Gifted students have special needs. They are different special needs, but they are there. And in my experience through the school, and I'm an active volunteer in our schools, is that the needs of the gifted students are less apt to be met than any other student's needs. And we're failing these students. These are our students who have an opportunity. They can soar when they are challenged. They are going to go out. They're going to be our entrepreneurs. Some of them may end up here at our legislature. They deserve that opportunity from an early age to be taught at their rate and level and to have their special needs met. And to do that, you must train the teachers. And in order to train the teachers, you have to provide funding. I'm going to make it short. You've asked me to keep it short. If you have any questions, I'd be delighted to answer them, and I really appreciate the opportunity to come today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, I just want to say that I think that that's a very, very good analysis of the inequity of the system, because I don't know that we are bound to meet the special needs at the upper end.
We actually have a TAG mandate in this state. We have a law that's been in existence for a number of years. The problem is it's an unfunded mandate and has been unfunded historically. And I would like to see that change.
Well, maybe you ought to file a lawsuit.
I am a lawyer, but...
No, really. I mean, if it is a matter of equity under the law, and we are bound to meet the special needs, if a student can demonstrate that they have special needs at the other end, then they should be allowed or have that material and those opportunities made available to them. That's an interesting...
He's opening a very big...
Chair Starr and Senator Morris said, I appreciate that. And even though I'm an attorney, my preference is not to file lawsuits, but to approach it from other angles.
I have to say that I have a bill that would... I'm concerned about psychotropic drugs used for students who are actually very bright, and
yes,
they're mistaken for having attention deficit, and that happens.
Well, my son is diagnosed as having mild ADD in addition to being highly gifted.
And I have a bill that will try to deal with that.
And there's a lot of crossover between those two communities.
So you come back when my bill is over.
I will give you my card, and if you will have your staff contact me, I'll come back.
Come on, let's go.
A
little order here.
I'm sorry, Chairman.
It's getting away from me. Please.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, thank you for the opportunity to come today. I come in support of Senate Bill 849 and 850. I am a parent. I'm also on the board of Oregon Association for Talented and Gifted. I'm from Portland. This is my handout It's, to me, a graphic description of what happens to a child, a gifted child, when his needs aren't met in the classroom. The first one is his handwriting, the beginning of school. The second handout is about 6 weeks later, his handwriting became connected sticks. Unfortunately, he was identified as gifted, but his teacher had no training in meeting his needs. He was not provided appropriate curriculum, and that was the result. He had trouble paying attention. He had an inability to focus on details. He was forgetful. He had trouble staying seated. He didn't do his homework. He eventually shut down. He wasn't doing anything, not even his after-school activities. He ordinarily enjoyed music, piano lessons. He stopped doing anything. You can see from these examples of handwriting, this child was going to become a statistic. It is a very slippery slope, that bad boy phenomenon that starts to happen. I pulled him from that district and I moved him to another state where the state mandates services to gifted. They also mandate that the teachers are trained. This is a public school system. You can see from the next handout, high school, outstanding student, outstanding academics. He took advanced placement chemistry in the eighth grade as a result of them moving him along. Chemistry was his passion. A strong advanced placement program speaks volumes about the rigor of the whole curriculum and about expectations for all students. As a result of taking advanced placement chemistry in the eighth grade, he started at the university half-time at age 13, and he did research for NASA on the space shuttle. He presented his research findings to the Nebraska Academy of Sciences when he was 15, and his part-time job was as a church organist at 16. The United States Department of Education report of 1993 tells us that curriculum in the United States is dumbed down one grade level every 10 years. The American Psychological Association report of 1998, called The Rising Curve, tells us that IQ is increasing at the rate of 3 points every 10 years. That is a widening gap. That is not being addressed in our schools. I ran across an article from the Oregonian in 2000 where the Department of Juvenile Justice was providing instruction to children in its care during the summer. The average student moved up from fifth grade math to eighth grade math after a 5-week session. At the same time, same day, same paper, there was an article about high-tech companies asking Congress to vastly increase visas for skilled foreign workers, such as computer programmers and engineers. I believe they're here. I believe we have them. We just aren't teaching them, and we aren't training our teachers. Thank you for your time. I'm in support of 849 and 850.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Greg Goodenough, and I'm a freshman currently at Willamette University. And I understand your time limit, and I'm already 45 minutes late to baseball practice, so I'll keep it brief. I'm here on behalf of my mother. Her name is Betty Goodenough Palmer. She's currently the president of OTAG, and she's unable to make it, and last minute called me up and asked if I could come over across the street and meet before you guys. You already have a handout in front of you with her message, and she gave me a brief, but it's still not that brief, so I will opt to not go over that at this time. You can read her comments. But just to speak from a personal note, I'm a TAG student all throughout school, and I've been in, grew up in the district, Baker School District, Eastern Oregon. Mr. Ferrioli is from Pendleton. I appreciate Eastern Oregon help over there, but TAG, just to reiterate everything that these women have been saying and everybody's been saying, it makes a huge difference to have teachers who can push you and can challenge you and can give you opportunity to learn and to grow. And classes where, even at college level, classes where dumb it down and just give you this and give you that and they don't excite you, you're just going to go to the minimum. You're going to meet the benchmark, and some are going to go below the benchmark when they have the capability to go much higher. And I appreciate that you guys are looking at this issue, and I thank you for allowing me to talk before you today.
Questions? Thank you, Greg. Appreciate you coming over, and appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Senator Kate Brown.
Good afternoon. For the record, State Senator Kate Brown represents Senate District 21 here on both Senate Bill 849 and Senate Bill 850. Thanks for giving these bills a hearing. And, Mr. Chair, I believe I missed your testimony on a bill in my hearing, so I'm delighted to have the opportunity to testify in front of you this afternoon. As you know, to be a TAG student, a student must be in the top 3% in mathematics, reading, language, arts, or aptitude in nationally standardized tests. There are 48,000 identified TAG students in Oregon, roughly about 9% of all Oregon students. This means there's a gifted student in every school and possibly in every classroom. The Oregon Education Act for the 21st Century states that students who exceed benchmarks are entitled to additional services. However, Oregon has not provided any mechanism or support for districts to even create these services. According to the Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development, achieving a world-class competitive workforce will require the state to significantly increase the number of students graduating from Oregon's universities with math, science, or engineering degrees. My niece, Mr. Chair, who lives in the great state of Minnesota, where I was raised, as an eighth grader, is taking the bus to the high school to have her math needs met. It's fair to say that I did not get the same math genes that she has. So I know that there are other states working hard to meet these students' needs, and I think we should as well. The two bills, Senate Bill 849 is primarily teacher training. It earmarks funds for TAG professional development. It would provide staff development training to meet the needs of TAG students, including assessments and ways to differentiate curriculum. The money would enable these teachers to be more effective with all of their students. And the Senate Bill 850, the AP program, provides $550,000 for improving participation in the advanced placement program. It would be used to provide assistance with AP exam fees for students who qualify under the federal free and reduced lunch program. Over half of all the AP students plan to major in medicine, engineering, and science and math. So those are my comments. I do think the student that was here, and I'm sorry that he's probably already left, should get extra credit, even though he's missing baseball practice for being here this afternoon. I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
A comment. I just came across a book recently, the students that he got taught. It's very new. In April of 2000, the state of Ohio chartered a charter school called the Peacock District. And they thought they were going to reach homeschool students by providing every student a computer in their home. What in fact they found was that the students they enrolled, and they enrolled 3,000 at the end of the first school year, were primarily at both ends of the bell curve. And so with an individualized program delivered at home, teacher interactive, they in fact were reaching the most challenged, the most advanced students. And we're going to see changes in education that will astonish us in the next few years. I'm interested that we meet the challenge of educating every child to their potential. So thank you for your testimony on these bills.
Thank you, and thank you for getting these bills a hearing. So.
All right, we have several others. We still have an additional bill before us. I have imposed on my committee members to stay late. I will not do that today, but I will stay myself. We have Pamela Wiltz and Flannery. Marguerite DeBoos. And one other, Cheryl Hunter, not room at the table for everybody, but if you'll come on up. Here. introduce yourself and let us hear your testimony, please.
Chairman Starr and members of the committee, my name is Paula Wilkes, and I'm speaking to you from three voices. I am the mother of a first-year law student who was fortunate enough to be in elementary school prior to Measure 5 and was able to receive TAG services because of that. I speak from the voice of a former Eugene teacher who spent 25 years in the public schools advocating for gifted students. I speak from the voice of an assistant professor at Pacific University's College of Education in Eugene. My passion for appropriate education for all students is profound and all-consuming. I have driven here from Eugene to encourage you to take a bold step forward in order to save and enhance the academic and emotional lives of gifted students. I am not here to advocate for special education for TAG students. I'm advocating for an appropriate education, an education that meets the state's TAG mandate to teach to the appropriate rate and level of gifted students. In order for that mandate to have its intended impact, opportunity and funding must be given to teacher training, both at the pre-service and in-service levels. Teacher training and gifted education is vitally important. As it currently stands, the state of Oregon is promoting educational malpractice. We provide licenses to teachers, leading parents to believe the teachers are trained to meet the needs of their students. However, there is no requirement for teachers to be trained in meeting the needs of gifted students. Why do we believe that the parents of gifted students want their children to be taught by teachers who know nothing about gifted education? I had the great pleasure in the 1989-90 school year to have a fifth grade student who was gifted in math, reading, and intellectual ability. But Mike was best known for his skills as a cartoonist. He wrote and illustrated a children's book that I later sent to Disney Studios. This was the pullout that was in his book, created by a fifth grader. Can you picture where Mike is today at 23 years old? Is Mike working for Disney? Does Mike have his own graphics design company? Mike, one of the most gifted and creative students with whom I've had the pleasure to work, dropped out of the Oregon Public Schools. I wish teachers along Mike's journey would have understood his creative genius. He needed teachers who could arrange mentorships with graphic artists, who could find ways to take his cartooning into the classroom. Mike is another example of the need for teacher training and gifted education. Mary Ellen Jacobson, in her book The Gifted Adult, says, "To feel like an outsider, to constantly pressure yourself to hold back your gifts in order to fit in or to avoid disapproval, to erroneously believe that you are overly sensitive, compulsively perfectionistic, and blindly driven, to live without knowing the basic truths about the core of your being, too often this is the life of the everyday geniuses," her term for gifted kids, "who have been kept in the dark about who they are and misinformed about their differences. No one ever took them aside and explained, of course you're different. You're intense, complex, and driven because you're gifted. No one told them they cannot escape the fact that they will always be quantitatively, qualitatively, and motivationally different from other people. Nor do they know that these very same things that are the basis of criticism are fundamental building blocks of excellence and advanced development. My question to you is, can our state afford to lose this excellence? I am saddened to say that by the time you've heard my presentation and read these materials, you will have had a deeper introduction into the gifted and talented than most teachers licensed by the state of Oregon and charged with educating this precious resource. It is my hope that this committee will stand up to the challenge of providing an appropriate education for all of Oregon's students by putting forward Senate Bill 849 and ensuring that educators in our state receive training in meeting the academic and social-emotional needs of gifted students. Thank you for taking testimony on this long-needed opportunity for teacher training.
Thank you. I'll stay overtime because I'm going to ask this question, okay?
Okay.
Can our state afford to have our most gifted children become antisocial and commit antisocial acts and become master criminals and so on? I mean, some of the brightest people in the state of Oregon are probably locked up because of the experiences that you're talking about. I mean, the lack of experiences, the alienation. And I know a lot of very bright people. As a teacher, I've seen a lot of very bright kids alienated and leave and become antisocial.
No, and I think it's an irony today that someone was talking about the Oregon Youth Authority, because I'm afraid that's where many gifted kids end up. And then the other, the talk about drugs. Drugs are going to be the only thing we can do to keep these young, precocious kids paying attention in classrooms that aren't meeting the needs of gifted kids. So we either have to have funding to train how to deal with gifted kids, or we need drugs.
Well, we don't need to drug them down, though, the anti, the AD. That's my other bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I was just thinking of the irony of the bill that we heard on Tuesday relative to the testimony that we're hearing here today. We heard a bill on Tuesday that would require teachers to be certified as being competent in basic course content areas. What happens routinely is that new teachers get hired by a district they are certified to teach. They get an assignment that may or may not meet their skills. They may be, in fact, English or music teachers, and they get a science class or a math class, and they freely admit that they are not competent in the course content that they are assigned to teaching. And they're, you know, it depends on seniority, it depends on availability, it depends on all kinds of different social issues that have really nothing to do with matching the teacher to the class, and particularly with their competencies. And so we're listening to this bill on Tuesday, and here we are on Thursday, hearing parents and patrons that truly have an issue that has very big implications for Oregon's future socially and economically. And yet we're still not even doing something as basic as matching teacher skills with course competency areas. They're adding a dimension that is so far away from that.
Well,
and so different from that.
I guess I have to respond, because in my experience in 30 years of teaching in Springfield School District is that they do a very good job in matching teachers, tag teachers, and tag kids. I mean, they don't just randomly pick a person and say, you're going to teach AP. I mean, I think that the districts, for the most part, are very selective about who they put in tag courses.
Oh, no, I'm not referring to tag courses. I'm talking about basic course content. Mr. Chairman, I bow to the life experience of my good colleague from Springfield. I am not a teacher, but I know that 50% of all new teachers leave after 5 years. And so there's got to be some problems within 5 years. There's got to be some problems that have to do with, you know, keeping the teacher focused and challenged and engaged. And that sounds a lot like these problems keeping the kids focused and challenged and engaged.
Teaching is more than the knowledge needed. It's also the ability to deliver and to interact. And I have had 30 student teachers, and some of them left because I've had some very bright people who couldn't teach. So, you know, teaching is as much an art, as much of an art as it is the intellectual content. So it is a combination. But anyway, onward, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to take over the meeting.
Hey.
Thank you for your testimony. Please.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Marjorie DeBuse, and I am Director of Youth Enrichment and TAG Programs and Services at the University of Oregon. I also am an adjunct assistant professor in teacher education, and I appreciate the opportunity and kind of the segue to talk about, well, if we have teacher education and it's doing well, why don't we have teachers who know how to teach these kids? And in order to really give you the background, I think that that might be helpful, I need to just go over a very quick little timeline, and I'll do it very briefly, but I think that the context may help in understanding why we are where we are today and why the need is so great. My tenure at the U of O started back in 1980, and that was a time when, if you look throughout the state, there had been grant and aid programs coming through ODE that allowed districts to compete for funds to serve their gifted kids, and primarily those dollars were used for pull-out programs. I think something that you, Senator Morissette, that you were referring to when you said you take a TAG teacher, trained teacher, and put them with TAG kids. And a lot of that was happening. And as it became more and more prevalent, the U of O responded by developing courses in graduate education for teachers in that area. And then as it continued to develop throughout the state and more districts became involved, additional courses were added and a OUS TAG Institute was established at the U of O. And so U of O, in a sense, took the sort of became the lead institution for developing training for educators throughout the state. So we're about 1984 now. And that led into very strong interest and support through Oregon Association for Talented and Gifted and educators around the state, which led to passage of the mandate for gifted education in 1987. The interesting thing about the mandate, as you know, is that it asks that educators address the regular school program rather than providing a distinct and different type of program in more or less a pull-up model. In other words, you might say the emphasis was on mainstreaming. And so, in essence, it meant that every teacher in the state became or needed to become somewhat skilled in the area of gifted education. This was a different kind of model than even many states have to this day, but it recognized the fact that when you take a student and you provide services to them on Friday afternoon, they're still gifted Monday through Thursday, and they're still sitting there on hold and waiting for something to challenge them. So in the sense of being a positive direction, I think it's been very good. The response was, okay, we need to train teachers throughout the state. We received federal fundings to do that through the Jacob Javits dollars. Those went through ODE, went through Portland Public Schools, went through U of O to provide that component. Our master's and doctoral program in gifted education just grew and grew and grew. We developed a great deal of leadership in the state in this area, people who were trained and able to do teacher training, people who could go to the districts and be TAG specialists. And then in 1991, teacher education was eliminated at the U of O. Along with that, many of the services that had been provided through the districts were also cut, and we moved into a decade of declining services in both of those areas. As a consequence, we now have a whole group of teachers who have gone through teacher education during that period and who have never really gotten the kind of training that they need in order to provide appropriately challenging education for these kids. In addition, many of the people who had been specialists in the past were forced to go into regular classroom and were no longer available to districts. Consequently, we're now in a position where the expertise out there is very limited, and we have a great need to provide in-service, especially in-service training for teachers in this area. There's an adage which is a little bit depressing, but it says if a TAG student could get one really focused teacher every 4 years, they might make it through the system. That's a pretty sad statement about our educational program, and I certainly think we can do much better than that. I think these two bills could be very, very helpful in generating that kind of support. I would underscore the fact that the House Bill 50 relating to advanced placement is not just for TAG students, that any student who has the intention of going to college typically will benefit from an advanced placement option. So I encourage you, I am encouraged to hear your support, that you're voicing your concern for these students, and I appreciate your consideration of the bills and the time to hear me speak to them. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Hunter. I am coordinator of the University of Oregon Summer Enrichment Program for Highly Able Youth. This is a two-week residential program that has been in existence for 24 years at the U of O. We provide an opportunity for highly able and students who are identified as talented and gifted to come together with a community of other young people and adults who share their excitement about learning.
Over 80% of our participants are Oregon residents, and they represent a wide range of towns, 45 different towns just this last summer I counted. In this context, I have the opportunity to interact with over 200 students every summer, their families and teachers who are recommending them for our program. What I hear from parents is that they're frustrated about the limited opportunities that their students have in schools, and that their students are bored in their classes often. I hear from teachers that they are urging us to accept their student into our program because they have such limited opportunities in their own town, and they know that these kids would really benefit from the kind of program that we can provide for them. By the way, I have also handed out, besides my testimony, an information sheet that we use to advertise the program, and I thought that might give you a better sense of, or a little sense of, what's involved with the summer enrichment program. I also hear from students that they are looking for more stimulating experiences. These are kids that take 2 weeks out of their summer to attend classes for 6 hours a day in topics such as calculus, epidemiology, physics, chemistry, law. These are exceptional students. They also tell us after they've left the experience, and many of them many years later will communicate with us and tell us that this was the most memorable experience of their middle school and high school years, and that sometimes it's here at the Summer Enrichment Program that they have had an experience that has sent them on to what has become their chosen career. So just this little piece of time that they have in a program like ours is often incredibly significant. We are very limited in who we can serve, not only by size, but also because of cost. We are an entirely self-supporting program. We do not receive any state funds for the program. And we have an extremely limited funds for scholarships. Just last year, we were able to provide partial scholarships, which equaled an amount equal to about 2% of our total revenue to just 8 students. And in fact, this year, judging from the earnings on the small endowment that we have for scholarships, it's going to be about 1/10 of that amount. So there are many kids who cannot attend our program because of financial limitations. And I will say, too, that our program is probably about half the cost of many similar summer enrichment programs for talented and gifted students. So we do our very best to provide a service that fills the needs of these students, but it is just a drop in the bucket. From this experience, I can just reiterate all the other things that have been said today about the great need that's here and the great potential that we are not serving because of the situation in our schools, and I strongly urge you to support these bills as a way of moving in that direction.
Thank you. Any questions? Really appreciate taking the time to testify. Is there anybody else signed up to or wants to testify on these two bills?
Not, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 849 and Senate Bill 850. And we're going to open public hearing on Senate Bill, if I can find it here.
129.
And we have a couple of people signed up for that one. I've lost the sign-up sheet.
I'm not going to leave. I don't want to talk to you. So.
Here it is. please. It's been a long day. Appreciate your patience staying with us here. For the record, give us your name and your testimony, please.
All right. Chair Starr, members of the committee, thank you for finding time today to give us the opportunity to testify. My name is Diane Baldwin, and I am an education specialist in the Office of Private Career Schools at the Department of Education. With me is Lynn Fleming, program representative in the same office. We are here today in support of Senate Bill 129. This bill was written by the department to amend ORS 345, 5.080, one of the statutes governing private career schools in Oregon. We believe the proposed changes will better assist the department in the regulation of private career schools and ensure students in these schools receive quality education. SB 129 amends current statute in three areas. It exempts the department from contract bidding requirements so that in the event of a school closure, the department may quickly contract with a replacement school, ensuring that students may continue their studies in a timely manner. It allows the department to charge a fee for processing private career school teacher registrations and to charge a fee for providing copies of student transcripts. Finally, it addresses several minor housekeeping language changes. These changes do not impact the content or the intent of ORS 345.080. If a private career school closes and students are in the midst of a training program, the current law requires the school to provide the students an opportunity to complete a comparable program at another institution with no additional tuition cost to them. If the school does not make this provision, then the school is required to make a total refund of all tuition and fees to the students. If the closing school fails to meet either of these provisions, the administrative rule allows the department to utilize the tuition protection fund to pay the training cost at the second school for all students enrolled at the first school at the time of the closure. However, if the total payments to the second school exceed $75,000, the current statute requires that the department put a contract out for bid. The usual 60 to 90 day bidding process disrupts the emergency nature of the department finding another school in a timely manner. Senate Bill 129 would allow the department to bypass the competitive bidding process and directly contract with a second school. The state superintendent of public instruction would need to approve that contract, thus safeguarding the intent of state law and the competitive bidding process. OAR 581-045-0012 requires that all private school teachers be registered by the Department of Education. OAR 581-045-0067 requires schools, upon closure, to transfer student transcripts to the Department of Education, where they must be retained for 25 years. At present, the department is the custodian of tens of thousands of student transcripts. Currently, the department cannot charge a fee for processing teacher registrations or providing copies of these student transcripts. In the last 2 years, we have noted a significant increase in the number of requests for copies of student transcripts. This increase is related to employers requiring proof of education and or training. Also, many colleges are now acknowledging the validity of the education provided by career schools and are reviewing transcripts and granting transfer credit as appropriate. In the last biennium, the department processed 350 cosmetology teacher registration, costing the department approximately $10,000 in staff time, materials, and indirect costs. Additionally, the department received 576 requests for copies of student transcripts, resulting in costs of approximately $8,700, again in staff time, materials, and indirect costs. Since the department is mandated to provide these services, the collection of fees under this addition is only an effort to align revenue with services. Revenue with expenses. The housekeeping items that I referenced in the beginning are all a result of recommendations from the department's Assistant Attorney General Gary Corday and are just substitutions of words and for clarification purposes. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. If you have any questions, we'd be more than happy to answer them.
this bill apparently comes to us without any fiscal impact requiring, or do you know?
We don't have a fiscal from legislative fiscal, and I haven't prepared one yet, but it doesn't have a ways and means referral.
Okay. Thank you.
We apologize. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm not providing testimony. I was just here to answer
questions.
She just
came along in case.
just
I'm here for questions.
Third degree. Okay. Appreciate you coming.
All right. Thank you.
You bet. With that.
So, Steve, you're not going to talk today?
Steve is keeping track of us.
Steve, appreciate you, superintending, here. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 129 and adjourn the Senate Committee on Education.
Steve, just get your account.